Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to David Bleich about his book, The Materiality of Language: Gender, Politics, and the University. He discusses the intrinsically political character of all language use, and how androcentrism has shaped the course of academic inquiry. And he unpacks some of the implications of that for the way in which we should be conducting ourselves in academia today. I'm talking to David Bleich about The Materiality of Language, which offers a wide-ranging critique of the implications of modes of language use. David, how did this book come to be written?
There are two kinds of histories involved. One is a personal history of being responsive to language use in childhood, and the other is an immediate, by immediate I mean maybe, 30 years ago, experience in writing pedagogy in the United States. And so the writing pedagogy industry had been growing in a very productive way before it was abrogated suddenly by the canceling of a course at the University of Texas being taught by Linda Brodke. She had the foresight and insight to teach a writing course in terms of actual political issues that existed at the time in about 1990. But the course was voted into to be offered by the English department by a vote of 43-6. And then the university administration canceled it. And Linda Brodke went away from the University of Texas and went to California to a new job. And several other writing programs with us stopped in their tracks because they had developed a political awareness, and the university administrations were enraged at this independence of pedagogy, this exercise of academic freedom by teachers of writing, and so it was nationally in the United States it was stopped, and the whole writing pedagogy profession was redirected toward the teaching of argument only. So. And this was a very provocative development, and it happened largely because of the increasingly conservative and corporate sponsorship of universities. Because of that, you know, I wanted to look into the history of the university and see what historically the situation was. Well, what I found was that, in fact, from the founding of the university, universities had always caved in to their sponsors. The university was founded by churchmen, and often kings were main sponsors, but mainly the church for around, let's say, from the 12th century to the 18th century. The church was the principal backer of university. They were theology was the main subject. So it was this history that I discovered in just doing the reading in response to this local problem in the United States about the tyrannical and arbitrary, you know, censorship of writing pedagogy that took place around 1990. However, you know, I had long been interested in language from childhood, from home usage, And as a result, I started reading about it. And the two topics of how language has been treated and how universities have treated language, they came together in a single thought at one point, you know, back in, I don't know, after I finished my last book, Know and Tell, or maybe while I was doing my last book, Know and Tell, which came out in 98, which was also a response to this issue. But then I saw that the whole matter, it's not only the writing pedagogy that was distorted by sponsorship influence and self-interest. It was the study of language was repeatedly carved up and apportioned into little bits to various parts of the university from the very beginning. And any issue of language was censored, was reduced in its consequence. Now, let me just tell an example of that. The example is that is Lorenzo Valla in the 15th century, which is treated in chapter 2 of the book. Lorenzo Valla attempted to use his understanding of the history of rhetoric of Latin to apply to the study of law in the University of Pavia, where he worked. And he tried to do this in a gesture of collaboration. But in actuality, as historians have reported, his life was threatened, and he had to flee his own university and secure the protection of all people, the Pope, with whom he was friendly at the time. And so this was an extreme instance where teachers of language have noticed that their subject applied to other subjects. But this occurs routinely in today's university, namely teachers of language, if they merely say, you know, my subject has something to say about your subject, they're ignored, they're condescended to, and they're treated badly in the university, and the whole notion of collaboration is rejected. And the reason for it, the putative reason for it given is part of the issue of the materiality of language. Namely, that the most other subjects view language as a transparent medium and not as a material medium. They think it's largely spiritual, and they think that the principal function of language is reference. And the materiality of language, an idea that has been understood since before Plato, has been censored, and that those who don't subscribe to it, you know, subscribe to a sense that you cannot monkey, the sense of language that says you cannot monkey with the referential status of our language. And while we don't want to monkey with it, we certainly want to think of it and review it together and, you know, see if anything can be learned. So in my book, that many of the last, say, five chapters, all deal with that question of what happens when you examine the language of a variety of disciplines, because the university in general resists this collaboration and condescends usually to teachers of English, of literature, or to education teachers, and so on. I don't know, maybe that was a long answer.
No, it's a very interesting answer. The essence of your claim is that although you set out to expose the way in which the history of the university sort of brings its own constraints and structures with it, the essence of your claim is that the materiality of language influences the way we ought to be practicing academic life now.
Yes, that is exactly right. It's a critique of how academic life is practiced because of unconscious or automatic assumptions about language that most people hold, namely that the principal function of language is reference. That's an old prejudice, and science has taken it up you know, with a vengeance, but it's taken up as if it were absolute certainty that the principal function of language is reference. And that is, I think the history of the study of language shows that is just not true. The reason why this case can be made is that materiality and its precursor, nominalism, has been known all the time. As far as you can tell, people understood what nominalism is. It goes back a long way, and it has, during the university period and a little before, it was censored as heretical. It wasn't discredited by some argument that said it was, you know, a fantasy or a baloney. It was discredited as heresy. That means that it was censored. And lots of important people like Wycliffe and Ockham, you know, and even people like David Hume and Berkeley, they understood that about language, that it does not predict anything, that you cannot have absolute categories that show what the next instance is going to be. So they understood that nominalist principle. Many well-accomplished people understood that principle. And so the university, namely, did not follow it. They followed instead the belief that the referential function of language is the basis of language, and that is the opposite of the truth, especially given the fact of how language is learned, which is discussed in Chapter 5, namely that it's learned by a totalistic process that includes feelings, relationships, and the political scene of one's home. And so the use of language retains all of those factors as a person gets older. But the study of language has always been reduced, is isolated into its referential function, and it prevents any understanding of a lot of the other functions that are simultaneously taking place every time a person uses language. Okay, so last week in class, students asked what the difference was between materiality and nominalism. Why didn't I just write about nominalism? And the answer to that is important because it relates to the gender issue. That materiality as an issue was raised by Julia Kristeva as a matter of what happens when women begin to study language, because the study of language historically has always been done by men only. And so nobody thought to say, well, maybe this skews the understanding of language, except Robin Lakoff thought to say that, and Julia Kristeva and other women who, in our generation, my generation, which they are, you know, began raising those issues in the 70s and 80s. So materiality adds the political and bodily dimension to the understanding of language. And by political, I mean, you know, the relation of people, who, how much power and authority they have relative to one another. So that factor is not a part of historic nominalism, which just claim that categorical terms are just names, hence the word nominalism. They don't have a reference, that categorical, general categories like freedom and justice and even family do not have a specific reference until somebody gives them a specific reference for the occasion of speech. So the materiality people, the people who understood something different about language, namely its unescapable political function on every occasion, then had something new to say, something new to add to the nominalist tradition, which is that there's a certain interpersonal, social, and bodily circumstance that must be taken into account in any use of language. So for any use of language, that covers everything. But so my answer to that is yes, indeed, it covers everything and represents a different subject of language studies whose purview is to be able to study any uses of language, you know, critically and collaboratively, of course, but it wants to study any use of language in any context and to be able to bring issues up for discussion under those circumstances. And you can see that language now is sort of in universities is what should I say? It's in the linguistics department, for example, or if it's in an English department, it's literature or in a comparative literature. But there's no comprehensive sense of language studies, as Mary Pratt had suggested, that language studies is itself a comprehensive field that applies to all fields in much the same way that gender studies does, and is related to gender studies, because gender issue in studying anything has not been studied enough and not been taught enough to younger generations, or nearly enough for that matter. So materiality is a kind of a political enlargement of the long tradition of nominalism, which understood the actual function of language, namely that it's a tool. These male philosophers also understood this, like Wittgenstein, of course, and Derrida and Bakhtin. They also understood, and they're treated in my book. But they were struggling because they were in a male tradition. All of them were in a male tradition, and they realized something was very wrong with the study of language, and they couldn't quite identify it. But it was, I think, properly identified by Kristeva and Robin Lakoff, and so I decided that I would try to assert this view in the book, and that's what how the book developed as it did.
Yeah, I mean, it's irresistible to compare what you're saying to, if you like, the Chomskyan or generative position on languages, or the cognitive linguistic viewpoint as articulated through linguistics departments, as you say. I mean, it seems to me that what you propose differs in several respects. One of which is taking a much broader definition of language, and another of which is adopting the view more generally that it's not legitimate or effective or optimal, at least, to be able to try and carve off language and study it in isolation. Is that a fair assessment of some of the crucial local differences?
I would go a little further. I mean, you're very gentle, I think, in that description. It's downright mendacious to study language without reference to these other factors. There is discussion in the book about what Chomsky had achieved, and I think his principal achievement was the alerting of students of language of the universality of predication. That this remains the only universal that applies to all languages, namely they do have predication. But what Chomsky then did was say, if this is a universal, we must find a little switch in the brain, or a little an organization in the brain that does this. And that was a false inference, that just because it's universal does not mean it's in the brain. So because a similar argument of universality, let's say a male supremacy, is universal, and yet there's no way that it's in the brain, that this is a universal cultural development. And the same, I would say, is true of language, that there's a certain pragmatic quality about the development of predication. And in chapter 5, I try to describe why predication is so important, because it applies to both the individual words that infants learn and to sentences that develop later on in life. They all utilize this matter of predication and things dependent on one another. But that is the very thing that Chomsky has refused to study. He has refused to study that in reality, namely in performance, that things are predicated on one another, that predication is a mutual event and not a one where the subject is superior and the predicate is the dependent factor. He did not take that step like other male figures. He was just unable to understand what mutuality is and how it works. And so if you view the whole process of predication, which is indeed universal, then you see the matter of dependency is raised. And it is fairly well documented in the studies of infantile language acquisition that dependency is an essential factor in the learning of language, and you cannot have merely cognition take place without a strong affective component, which in the literature is rarely there. There are a few researchers which I cite who do bring the affective component into play, and all but one of them are female. And so that itself is a factor. So that you, in studying language, that the people who study it take a different attack than the men who studied it historically, and particularly Chomsky. On top of that, you know, there has been no affirmative results from Chomsky. Chomsky started his work in 1957 when I first came into college, and he made that claim at that time that there was competence and performance, and real scientists study competence. Well, since in those, over 50 years, almost 60 years, no one has found anything to correspond to confidence in the brain or anywhere else. It's just an abstraction without a reference. And in fact, many others, like Philip Lieberman, have insisted, and Liz Bates, maybe about the same time as Lieberman, insisted that the use of language is a total brain activity, which certainly makes sense given all the factors involved. But I don't really know. I don't study the brain, but I don't think it matters all that much in language, although it may come to matter a little more than it does now. Chomsky's effort, and the effort of people in cognitive science, just does not seem to occur to them that you cannot isolate cognition from everything else. Sometimes it seems that it's different, but it isn't. It's part of a single living organism, us. And we all of these factors must be at work in all of us people who are busy thinking and writing and doing things because we want to do them. So as soon as you say you want to do something, that's an individual motive. And as soon as you say that other people are doing it, that's a political motive or a collective motive, that's an interest, a professional interest. As soon as you say that, well, then you see you cannot isolate cognition. You cannot isolate competence. You cannot make branching tree diagrams and say that constitutes an explanation, because it's not an explanation. The use of language, to me, is much more properly described by Wittgenstein and Derrida, as well as Kristeva and Lakoff. You know, those I would isolate as principal figures in the discussion. And they all have different views than Chomsky. And so he has a bevy of male followers that have been loyal over the years. And it's a little boys club there, as Robin Lakoff had identified in one of her essays on the history of the study of language. So it's too bad, because everyone credits Chomsky with good mind and interesting politics, and a person who has directed the study of language in an important way. But it's simply erroneous, in my view, that this is not scientifically valid. Yeah, I'm a humanist, but it's just unscientific for a person doing observation to say, you know, performance is not a factor in language, when I think it's a principal factor, and the factor most available for scientific study, for empirical study.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying about the limitations of that particular approach to linguistics. I mean, I wonder whether more generally there's a dispute here about the nature of scientific study or the scientific process, which you discuss in some detail, to the effect of, you know, are simplifications justified? And if so, which simplifications are justified? It struck me that one of the difficulties associated with trying to study everything as a complex system is that it's almost impossible to make any of the kinds of generalizations that Chomskyans rightly or wrongly seem to be seeking after.
Yeah,
is that a reasonable objection?
I don't agree that it's impossible to make generalizations. I mean, it depends on what our aim is. For example, suppose our aim is to study negotiations with Iran on a nuclear activity that's taking place in Iran. So suppose our aim is that. Then we isolate the issue namely, which people are involved in this? What are the political stakes? What are they saying to one another? And then, what are the differences between English and Farsi, for example? What are the differences in the stakes? Who is participating in the discussion? So it's a guide. What I'm thinking is that the study of language is a guide to isolating situations in where amelioration of the use of language matters. I do not think it. I think it's self-evident that language is a means of survival for the human race, and plays a role in our lives, similar to the role that dam building and nest building plays in birds' lives. Language is a way of life. And so you don't just isolate a way of life. Sure, you can observe dam building and how complex it is. Well, yeah, that's what happens in beaver brains. But we don't need to look at the beaver's brain to take into account all the things beavers do to build a dam. The same thing with language. You take an instance of its use, and you look at what's involved in having it get the optimum use in a negotiation of a political nature like this, or negotiations that are less common now, but of union negotiations or congressional negotiations, like that took place in the United States Congress, where there was this tremendous tie up and everything ground to a halt because of the permissibility of some people saying the things they do without consequence. And so there's a certain understanding about what free speech is. This, if the country grinds to a halt because of what several people are saying in Congress, something is wrong. Well, it turned out well for now, but it's still one of those things where you use an occasion where language really matters in order to see if you can reach a generalization, but not to rule out a generalization, because there's no way to do that either. You can't rule it out and you can't rule it in. You need to say, well, we can make a generalization now. So let's say you're a scientist and you want to understand language as well as you possibly can. Says, well, what do? Well, you spend your life looking at salient instances of the use of language where people are involved, where feelings are involved, where our bodies are involved, where all kinds of people, all different languages are involved. The relativity of language, the Whorf hypothesis is extremely relevant, that people feel differently about life because they speak different languages. And we're well aware that this is a fact. So we need to look into that and bring that in. Is the subject, is it slow going? Yes, it's slow going. We're not going to find a transistor for this to illuminate it. We're not going to find a principle of special relativity that's everyone's going to say, oh my gosh, how come I didn't know that? You know, it's not going to be that way, but it still is certainly scientific because we're examining things. We're trying to observe things collectively in a sense that everyone has an interest in observing the things that everyone has an interest in observing, such as negotiations of nuclear weapons in other countries who don't have them now. That's an important, extremely important matter because the survival of all people is at stake for that. So do we need not to say this is not a matter of language? Well, that's foolish, it seems to me. This is partly a matter of language. It's a matter of a lot of other things, too. But certainly what we say to one another and whether we disrupt each other's feelings or each other's histories or each other's principles, you know, that all matters. And so why isn't that scientific? That's scientific. It's just not quantifiable. It's just not, you know, you can't predict it. You can't control it. So therein is the critique of classical science, is the overgeneralization, that predictability and quantifiability of the signs of science. No, they're not. The signs of science are understanding. Understanding is reached from a wide variety of sources. And since I've been a literature teacher for many years, you know, I understand that fact, that understanding reached from literature is not quantifiable, but it's nevertheless as reliable an understanding as the understanding reached from a calculation or a statistical chart. it's equally reliable, and maybe in different contexts, but it's reliable, it's understanding. Well, why shouldn't all subjects yield understanding? That's not how it is now. Right now, it's only science can yield understanding, and that's just flat out untrue.
I mean, I guess a question is then whether this is to do with the idea that, for example, linguistics is being overambitious in the generalizations it claims to be able to make. I mean, it strikes me that, to take your objection in the, you know, in the most serious possible terms, that if one were to try and understand the negotiations between the US and Iran about Iran's nuclear program, that to do that it's necessary to understand in a profound sense what distinguishes those countries, those cultures, the languages that are spoken.
Exactly.
But which doesn't in some sense generalize to other situations. So in some sense, it's not obvious there should be anything we can say about those negotiations which would also apply to the negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea about its nuclear program, or between the U.S. and Iran about economy or economics or so on.
Yes, I disagree with that because in the North Korean situation, one would equally have to take into account what happens in the North Korean language and the history of that language and the history of users of that language and that culture, you know, and why did it turn into the kind of place it did turn into? All of that needs to be, it's a total cultural issue. So that to me, that's very useful knowledge. That's not, you can't just lift it out of Iran discussions and go into North Korea. But you want to move on maybe to Congo and to see how to control the rape gangs that are going on there, have been going on for many years, where they're running around. Each of those require different forms of talk. But the common assumption is that there's a different language, there are different people, and that the people trying to understand all of those crisis points and trying to use negotiation to ameliorate them need to ask a whole set of other questions that you just can't lift from one situation to the other, but you can certainly discern an analogy between an adversarial meeting and a friendly meeting or a partially adversarial meeting or a neutral party. There's so many different permutations of relationships. That's all I'm getting at. I mean, generalization is not of the traditional sort. It's where you see analogies. And by the way, this figurative analogical thinking was well recognized by some people, even in the 18th century, as a more reliable basis for language. And I discussed one of these people, Heyman, in I think chapter 4. This is part of what's understood, namely that there are these figurations that are taking place in all languages. And these have to be understood. If they're not understood, you can see this problem will come up in translation things. There's certain figurative usages in different languages that can't be translated into our native language. So as soon as that's admitted, the procedure is different. Wouldn't you agree? The procedure for negotiation of critical situations is different. Once you agree that figuration is taking place in all languages, well, then you need to interpret those figures. So yes, is that unscientific? Well, of course not. It's neither scientific nor unscientific. It reaches understanding, and it doesn't have a sacralized a standard to compare it to. It has a standard of mutual understanding, and that seems to me that people can understand that understanding is not the same as classical science, and science has been given too much room to do what it damn pleases for my taste.
Yeah, I mean, I take the point. What I really meant was not so much that everything should go across automatically, everything that we learn in one field should generalize to other fields. Because this is, of course, as you know, disputed in linguistics on a number of levels, particularly a recent focus on the idea that we're studying from a psycholinguistic viewpoint disproportionately European or American educated college students, throughout, and trying to make generalizations that may or may not go across to other people. Yeah. I suppose my question was more whether anything went across, whether there were any kinds of generalization that we could take from one language to another, from one culture to another, from one gender to another, from one agonistic interaction to another.
Absolutely. I completely agree that one can, but it varies. And the gender thing is particularly interesting because, you know, there are many of us who think that male and female are much more alike than different. And I grew up thinking that there's these radical differences between male and female. But as I got older and I listened more to the claims of others, that I decided that, no, we're not all that different, but there are differences that we have not been taking into account. So that's where I stand. That not that you can or cannot make generalizations, but that we need to look at the situation with a little less sense that we already have the apparatus that will provide enlightenment, because I don't believe we have such an apparatus. We have poor attitudes. And so that's all I think that I'm proposing, that if we think of language a little differently, not that much differently, but a little differently, namely that it is a material item, and not really an object, but a material entity or an item or a practice. It could be a lot of different things. We don't have as much prejudice in facing the uses of language. We don't have as much fear that, you know, we're not going to find or we are going to find. We have toned down ambitions to find ultimate. We don't want to find ultimate answers anymore, as the physicists want to find the theory of everything. I mean, what a foolish enterprise that is. We're no longer looking for transcendental understanding. We're looking for understanding that will help us survive as living things. That's all. We were here for a short time. And to me, the ultimate value is that we actually try to survive. So that's what's up. I completely agree that no one does not generalize. Anybody generalizes. But the only issue is, how shall we generalize? How shall we do it? And why aren't we working more together in order to find things that we agree on? What's a generalization pragmatically? It's something that you and I agree on. That's what a generalization is. It's nothing more than that, that we agree that this is the case, such and such is the case. So we have more people believing in more things, then we call it a generalization, but it's just a constituency has come up. You know, it's like a genre is like a derivative of generalization, or the other way around. There's a collective sense of how things are. That's how we've begun to trust the knowledge. That's almost never used in terms of scientific knowledge. That's trustworthy, because we use the word trust to apply to people only and not to understanding that we all have. So how do we come to trust knowledge? Well, partly because authoritative people tell us to do that, but also because many of us trust certain things at once. And so it's trustworthy because a lot of people believe it. But we also know equally that just because a lot of people believe something doesn't make it trustworthy. So how do you react to that common fact at once, that when a lot of people believe something, we trust it more? At the same time, we know that when a lot of people believe something, that doesn't automatically make it trustworthy. Now, how do you respond to that formulation of the issue?
Me personally?
Well, I'm a spokesperson for linguistics, for example.
Oh, well, it relates to a question I would like to ask, which is connected with, you know, scientific practice in general, because you make the point that, like, the scientific community has arrogated to itself a particular status to demand trust and not be challenged.
Correct.
And, I mean, there are some aspects of that. I agree with it as an observation. But I'm a little conflicted about it, because on the one hand I see bad practice in, you know, a wide variety of fields, some of which is attracting plenty of attention and some of which just is kind of creeping by unnoticed. And on the other hand, there's, if you like, some ideal of good scientific practice, which this scientific community, in which I include myself, believes as a route to explanation, insight, whatever. And I wonder whether you would share the sense that there is, in some sense, a kind of practice that we can trust, and what has gone wrong is that people have been diverted, or have diverted themselves from that path, whilst continuing to claim all the advantages of it, or whether you think that, you know, that idea of there being a particular procedure that makes sense, that delivers outcomes of this kind, is fundamentally an incorrect notion.
Well, I think it's just much too dangerous to expect a single scientific method or procedure to obtain. It's just, there are so many different areas where understanding is needed. Now, how in the world can there be a single procedure for understanding it, except a language procedure, namely, what is our stake in this issue? I mean, is that a scientific question? Yes, I think. Is that a question of a humanistic question? Yes, it's a humanistic question. Yes, it's a scientific question. The categories themselves are inadequate. So we want to strip away some of these extra superstructures of inquiry to say, what is our stake? In an hour, I'd say, well, are we looking at a society? Are we looking at a country? Are we looking at the industrialized West? Are we looking at us as babies in school? What is the word meaning our, you know, which is used routinely in describing the reports of scientific investigations, we and our? You know, what is this we? What is our stake? So everything is susceptible of asking, why do we care? Is it not? Isn't that true? Why does it matter to investigate this? Well, let's say I ask the question. I raised this before, and people say, well, what about knowledge for its own sake? And I say, there is no such knowledge of knowledge for its own sake. There's only knowledge for the sake of whoever looks for it. So what's wrong with abandoning this sense of knowledge for its own sake? We have no time to indulge ourselves to seek knowledge for its own sake. Well, okay, then people then say, look, so many inquiries of knowledge for its own sake have led to knowledge that's really useful. Okay, say, take for example the development of radar. In World War II, well, that's not knowledge for its own sake, but knowledge for the sake of war making. So they say, oh, that's bad knowledge. All right. It's not really. Now airlines are regulated by the use of radar and cars and all sorts of safety equipment. Things were not developed for its own sake. Let's say the computer people back in the 50s who were developing these huge mainframe computers, they say, oh God, this is fabulous. We can make a human being ultimately if we just keep on this path. So it's knowledge for its own sake. You know, why they want to make a human being out of silicon, I don't understand, but that's what they want to do. What is this knowledge for its own sake? Well, it led to the equipment we're now using for this discussion, which is a good thing. But I think that would be false reasoning to think of the search for knowledge for its own sake is necessary in order to lead to accidental discoveries, when in fact deliberate knowledge can be or knowledge that we already have can be imagined as conceivably of use, which is different from knowledge for its own sake. Wouldn't you agree that it's conceivably you can say, well, this looks like it can help us. Let me follow this path, even though I don't know what the outcome is, because it conceivably is useful. That's a different policy in doing research than seeking knowledge for its own sake. That's all. It's not radically different, but it's different because it takes into account other people's interest, why we're interested, what use it is, where it'll stay in the real world. So do a little Gedanken experiment for that. Look at the Hadron Collider in Switzerland and the superconducting super collider that was canceled in the United States. You ask, well, they were going to spend $50 million, and Steven Weinberg was upset because it was canceled. It was building in Texas where he could work with it. So what is that knowledge for its own sake, to find the fundamental particles? I can't think of a single result. The result of the study of nuclear particles, except the nuclear bomb. single result that has come out of the study of so-called fundamental particles, except the nuclear bomb. Nuclear bomb came out of that. Now, who has that helped? Who's the nuclear bomb helped? Now everyone has one, and it has helped no one and put the world in jeopardy. Why did they look for that? Well, they looked for that because, well, maybe for war-making purposes, because the Germans also looked for it, and the United States got it first, and so of course we used it. But what is the Hadron Collider good for? You tell me. What understanding? How does that understanding help anybody who is walking this earth?
I've got to be honest and say I can't tell you, but I have a feeling the physicists would make a better case for it than I'm able to. I'm not going to try and do their job.
That's all right. I just I don't think so. I read what the physicists had to say. They never address that issue. They don't address it at all. They believe that they're coming to the secret of the universe. You read them, read Lawrence Krauss, and it's amusing.
Oh yeah, but I wouldn't. I mean, their you know, preconceptions about what they're doing are one thing, but I think, you know, some other people might be able to make use of their stuff to perhaps deliver something a little bit more helpful.
I hope so, but that hasn't happened.
I'd like to turn back, if I may, to a topic that we mentioned earlier in the talk and didn't really follow through, which is one that's very central to your book, which is the theme of gender, or this, you know, the major analytical lens of your approach is this. The impact of the andocentric nature of academic practice. How central is this?
It's extremely, I don't know whether central is the term, but it's an overwhelming fact of our lives, of human life, and the human society and human cultures. It's an overwhelming fact. And so I go back and look at my own experience in school, and I remember learning how to discount the fact that only men have done the research. I learned in school, since I was a man, and I went to an all-male high school in New York City and an all-male college in Boston, and I learned to discount the fact that understanding was achieved only by men. Now, of course, I wasn't even told that understanding was also achieved by women. I wasn't told that, and I never occurred to me to ask. I don't know if it's true in your life, since you were born much later, but my experience has been that I have never been made aware by any teacher that all, even by female faculty members in graduate school, which I had, that all understanding was developed by men. The understanding that we're getting was developed by men. Now just consider that for a moment. If that's true, why haven't we learned about it before 1980? 1980! You know, when the third wave of feminism came around and discovering reality by Harding and Hittiker came around and raised these issues for the first time, you know, all society, Congress, the Houses of Parliament, what is the percentage in the Houses of Parliament? You can answer that question. What is the percentage of women in the Houses in Parliament?
I should know that, but it's about 20%.
Well, there you go. It's the same in the Senate in the United States. Now, what does that mean about the government of societies if it's done only by men? So is that a central fact? Well, for God's sakes, it's not central enough in my book. It's simply pointing out that it is central, or that it does matter more than we ever imagined. The women have been claiming this. You know, actually, yeah, there are sources. I think the epigraph of Christine de Pizan in the 15th century of the book cites a source that notices this fact. And she thinks, how can it be that all these men hate women? How can that be? It was the 15th century, so... So it went back to before that, the women in classical times as well, that women have noticed this, but it's not been part of mainstream knowledge. And men have been successful in diverting attention from this essential question. And it is so important. And it, to me, if there is any basis for hope for the survival of life on this planet, is if the human species recognize that both halves of the human species need to be involved in helping us survive. And that's not the case now. So that's why it's important. This gender matter had better happen. And for example, somebody has suggested that maybe every undergraduate should take a course before, as a requirement for graduation, should take a course in gender studies. Well, that's a very good suggestion, and I think every undergraduate should. Now, many women will say, well, we don't need that, but that is not true. Many women do need it, because women also are affected by this male wind that's blowing, that says that it doesn't matter that only men have governed societies for 8,000 years. Well, it definitely does matter. And many women don't really understand it until they're old enough to have children and they're stuck with all the problems that have two jobs. And one is to take care of children. The other is to earn a living. This is in Western industrialized West. I don't know how it is in China or India or in the Congo. But this factor is universal. This we'll call up Chomsky and inform him about the universality of androcentrism and the male supremacy and misogyny. It's universal, and it is one of the things that require. I'll give you another example. I've been teaching for about 50 years, and I think only in the last 2 or 3 years has any student, and it's my prompting, as any female student say, I can't come to class because I have my period and I don't feel well. So this is only because I said it's okay to say that. If I didn't say that, they would not ever say that I can't come to class because my menstrual cycle is making me feel bad. Yet this must have happened throughout my teaching career, and no one has ever spoken up. They may be absent. They may say they may lie. But imagine what the mind of a woman is, who feels that I cannot say that I'm not feeling well and I can't behave normally because my regular menstrual cycle, which is not a disease. So they can't say that. Put yourself in their shoes. Those you have to lie about it all the time. What would happen to your head? By you, I mean anyone. What would happen to your head if you had to lie about what's happening to your body as a matter of normal, you know, development, or as a matter of expected things happening? Well, women have had to lie about it. So look how urgent that is. That just a little thing like that, let alone not reporting rapes and beatings and things like that, as Nicholas Kristof has constantly tried to report, that these things are going on all the time, and it's not reported. It doesn't matter. It's not folded into the whole agenda of things that laws that have to be enacted. It's not discussed in classrooms. It's horrible. It's downright horrible. So yes, it's a central factor, but that's not quite saying enough. I probably didn't do it justice. I even left out some sources that I should have included in the book because it didn't appear. I tried to be as candid as I can. But even so, since my habituation is otherwise, I didn't succeed in including everything that probably should be included.
Well, I think you make a compelling case for these issues, particularly in the humanities, where you talk about Freud and the interpretation of his views from that lens, and I think make a very 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 powerful case. What I really wondered about was the issue that you mentioned once or twice and where there's been rather heated dispute concerning the, if you like, the legitimacy of what's sometimes called white male science.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's not intrinsically wrong. It's just that it's incomplete. That's all. It looks exactly as you foregrounded it or gave a premonition of it, namely that how can we generalize? I believe it's a male-coded impulse or a male-coded practice to search for that generalization rather than to wait and make the generalization after one has thought through what the possible research procedures will be and to make a generalization only that applies. The male science, with its heavy reliance on calculation and numbers, I don't think it takes a great imagination to see that this is a matter of control and dominion over. This is highly recorded and I think documented in my book. You know, like Bacon, it's documented in David Noble's book, A World Without Women. It's about the history of science and how male white male it has been. So we haven't begun to ask this question about. It's not as if the telescope is unimportant or Avogadro's number is suddenly false. It's none of that. It's that what else might be considered along with these. How else do we do astronomy? Yeah, we need to look at it, absolutely. But what question shall we ask about that? That's the one area of physics where there are more women than other people is astronomy. What shall we ask about it? Because it's very hard to do experiments in astronomy because there's light coming in and you don't know where the hell it's coming from. Let's hear what kind of question. We don't even know. You know, we don't even know if the science was equally populated by male and female. It would certainly be different than it is now. I don't know. I think I cited a few sources, like from the history of the Royal Society in Britain, that how misogynistic it was, and yet it was a wonderful organization because it was independent men, you know, means who came together who wanted to find stuff out. Well, I thought that was great. But no one bothered asking because it was such a good idea. No one bothered saying, well, they all hate women. what's going on? I mean, there's that question. What's going on? What they just have a good idea. They get together. They do experiments. They have a society that's still functioning. They printed everything in the vernacular. They didn't stick to Latin. You know, what? How come they all hated women? So don't you think we should ask that question? I mean, you may be familiar with the Royal Society.
Well, not intimately, but these are some topics I would love to talk about a lot more. But unfortunately, our time is nearly up, and I have to ask before we go, you open up so many possible avenues of research in your book. What are your own personal priorities going forward?
Yes, I do have one, oddly enough, which I don't know if I'm going to live to do it, but I have it. I'm working on a shorter book. Called The Matter with Men. And it has to do with the fact that men derive their power from each other. That historically, there has been a bonding of men. Not all men, but many men, and especially those who have guns and money. There's a certain group psychology that goes into effect that transcends the individual interest of men, so it's not in the genes. It's sort of a social practice that men learn early because it's inherited. It's analogous to what Nancy Chodorow wrote in The Reproduction of Mothering. It's sort of like the reproduction of male hegemony is the topic, or reproduction of misogyny, something like that. That men bond together in a way. That is, it's nicely described actually in two places by Ong and by Conrad Lorenz, which I do deal with in the book. But there's a kind of a mystical union that is both inherited, not really mystical, but a spiritual or social union that happens. And many men, especially those who are ambitious and who want to achieve a lot and who want power, you know, they assemble a collective of people who have their backs and on whom they can rely. A good example would be the police, the prostitution. One of the things that keeps prostitution going is that all of the police and the lawyers and the judges who have responsibility to oversee prostitution are themselves customers. And so because they're customers and they have a silent agreement with each other that it's okay to be a customer, so then nothing changes with the regulation of prostitution, which many women and many prostitutes have said, well, it should be decriminalized, there should be a different way in which it's handled, but it's handled the old way because of male bonding with one another. So I'm working on that, and there are several books by men, and there are many books by women, you know, like Peggy Reeves Sanday, Fraternity Gang Rape, the very, very good book. Other studies of Lionel Tiger's Men in Groups that are older and who've tried to face this problem. So I'm going to try to use literary sources and social sources and political sources to discuss this issue of how the collective male ideology has been developed and transmitted for so long and why it's so hard to break it. How's that?
That's great, and I look forward to reading about it and hearing a lot more about it when you're more advanced in the project. But for now, I shan't consume another hour of your time to talk about it. David Bleich, thank you so much for your interview.
I've been talking to David Bleich about the materiality of language. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.